This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our show is called Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across the state this time of day. Those real Main Streets where we meet and greet each other and talk about what's on our minds, share our news and opinions, are vital centerpieces in our communities. And today, as we approach that Main Street and maybe hunker down in the breeze because it's still winter here, we might thinking of a hot party somewhere like Shrove Tuesday or Pancake Tuesday or Fat Tuesday or Carnival or Mardi Gras. Different names for the same time of year, getting ready for Lent. In the United States, Mardi Gras is the biggest party of the year in New Orleans, and the lead funsters for Mardi Gras festivities are groups known as crews. Well, Ashley Thornburg is just back from taking in the sights, sounds, and food of New Orleans with tips and insider information from Minnesota native Melissa Cossack Anderson, who rode on a royalty float in the crew of Freret.
Starts on Epiphany, which is on 12th night, so January 6th. So we honor Christmas, and then as soon as Christmas is over after 12th night, we can start celebrating the coming holiday of Mardi Gras, which is fattening yourself for Lent.
What's a crew?
A crew is a social aid and pleasure club, and they usually have a philanthropic arm, so they have some sort of charity or organization that each crew benefits. One of our largest crews in the city is Toth, and Toth is heavily involved with the Children's Hospital. In fact, they add over a mile to their parade route every year so that it can go around the Children's Hospital so that the children can experience it.
You guys have really elaborate throws.
I was expecting some Tootsie Rolls.
the better the throw, the more people will holler for it. So every rider actually buys their own throws. So the good riders will buy the throws they want to catch.
So it costs a lot of money to be in Mardi Gras, to put this on for other people.
Yes, so it's been called like the greatest free party in America or the greatest free party on earth. But typically the crews are paying for the parades, the members are paying the crews, and all the members individually and riders individually pay for their throws, which is a gift to you. So historically, the female members of the crews would actually hand make each item. Like they would hand string seed beads, like glass seed beads. And that was the original bead. We actually just began importing the plastic, colorful, shiny bead that you see most commonly today. That's only been in the last 30 or 40 years that's become a trend. And lots of crews have a signature throw. For example, the Zulu coconut can have a pretty high street value for tourists on Canal on Mardi Gras Day. We're decorating the signature throw for the crew of Ferret is a mask that has a fleur-de-lis shape in between the eyebrow. And those masks are the signature throw, and they are hand-decorated by the members of the crew. And I'm also throwing glass beads and glass bracelets. Bracelets are going to be interesting because they're so small. I think I'm going to have to hand them to people. Fabulous marching band. It's more important than an alumni association.
How long are these schools preparing for their Mardi Gras parades, would you guess?
Preparing for Mardi Gras is year-round, and in some cases, like when you're training up a drum major, you might start them as an elementary school student, and then they'll march with the high school. You'll get to see that. We call them the itty-bitties. Usually they march with their older sibling, or maybe a parent is affiliated with that school, so they're being groomed and conditioned.
So Mardi Gras is not an event. Mardi Gras is a lifestyle.
Mardi Gras is a season. Mardi Gras is what happens in between Christmas and spring.
Now, I'm seeing a distinct lack of, boobs being shown for beads. What do you want to say to the tourists who just think this is what happens on Bourbon Street, and then that's it? And we know what happens on Bourbon Street.
Bourbon Street is sort of like Disney World. It's an amusement park that perpetuates an idea. People come there from Wisconsin or Minnesota or North Dakota and think that you lift up your shirt and that's how you get beads. And so they do that, and then people give them beads because those people have also seen the same stereotype. Mardi Gras is a family holiday with Catholic tradition. It's about spending time with your neighbors and celebrating community. And there's plenty to see and do that's not on Bourbon Street. In fact, there are zero parades on Bourbon Street. Across from us, there's a wooden rocking chair and children on ladders with blankets. And it says, thank you for making our Mardi Gras our favorite holiday. We celebrate families. There's often like a barbecue or a crawfish boil on the neutral ground. You spend all day with your friends and neighbors. And no matter what you do, you say, happy Mardi Gras to everybody you see.
Oh, I almost got smacked in the face.
There's a tambourine.
Oh, man. Why do the crews do this?
It's a really challenging question. The first Mardi Gras kind of honored the king and things that are patriarchal and traditionally rather white in nature. So the New Orleans Mardi Gras culture is heavily centered around satire and sort of poking fun at the King of Rex and all of the traditional sort of French descendant Mardi Gras traditions.
You're expecting. How will you pass on these traditions?
I suspect that our newest edition will love parades just the same way that we do. And probably march as well. They're going to go to school in this city, which means that they'll march. So we're at a break in the parade. Those happen sometimes because the floats are old, the axles will break down, so there'll be a gap in the parade. And it's an important gap. You need to have a gap every once in a while. Otherwise, the people who are on the sidewalk side, which is where we're standing, can't cross over to the neutral ground side. And when you have friends who are riding in the parade, that's how you tell them where you are. You say, like, I'm float 9 on the sidewalk side or float 9 on the neutral ground side. So when you want to catch your friend, you have to wait for a break to get to the other side if you need to cross.
There's a historical significance to a term like neutral grounds.
So historically, neutral ground in New Orleans means that it's neutral to all parties, all races, religions. So even in the time of segregation, neutral ground was where all races were welcome in between the roads.
I've seen a lot of Cajun and I've seen a lot of Creole, and those are not interchangeable words.
Maybe in food, but definitely not in people. Creole implies that it's an Afro-Caribbean French combination, or there's even, Indian, African-American Indian, that can all be incorporated into Creole. Whereas if you Cajun, you came from Acadia. Acadiana is the part of Louisiana where the French left Canada and migrated to Louisiana and settled. So Cajun is Acadian, just with a Cajun French accent. Also tomatoes. So tomatoes can be a distinction between Creole and Cajun food.
Oh. Yeah. Give me an example.
So a Cajun jambalaya, for example, would not have tomato, whereas a Creole or a New Orleanian jambalaya does. We have a delicious thing called the yakimane here, which is a cup of steaming soup that is a concoction that's sort of like Asian, African, and Italian cuisine all in one cup. Broth takes days, and only professional yakimane broth makers can make the broth for the yakimane. And usually you have to get it off of a push cart on the side of the street somewhere. You can't go to a restaurant and order yakimane.
This is definitely one of the strongest food cultures I've ever seen in the city.
The food culture is global. It is spicy. It is salty. And we have the highest heart disease in the country. But we're happy people. We're happy people who eat well. It's true.
How did you first get to Louisiana?
I spun a globe and put my finger on it.
This is a true story?
Yes.
That's how you picked where you're going?
Yeah. At 18 or 19 years old, I was moving back to America from being overseas in Australia, and I spun a globe. Fell in love with everything from the food to the streets to the culture, and it's always felt like home since then.
Put out your hands.
Hey, that's my first catch.
There you go. There you go.
I caught something.
Okay, they throw beads around. Did you catch anything?
I did. It took a while, and I got hit in the face a couple times first because I was holding my recorder. The first thing that I actually caught was a light-up ball. And this is just sort of a fun fact. You actually aren't supposed to pick up the stuff on the ground and keep it. It is supposed to be that kind of art that is of the moment. You are supposed to catch that. Now, they do have crews come around afterwards and clean up because there is a bit of a mess that is generated, but crews spend a lot of time cleaning that up and recycling, and they get it out of there fast.
All right, well, let the good times roll. Coming up on Main Street, the National Trial Competition is coming to North Dakota this weekend.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The phrase midlife crisis has become a cliched joke. It inspires images of men with sports cars and trophy wives, but it's real for many men and women. So what does a midlife crisis look like through a philosophical lens? On the next Wire Radio, we'll find out. Join me and my guest Kiran Setia as we take a philosophical look at midlife crisis on the next Wire Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Catherine Rand. She is the dean of the UND School of Law. Thanks for being with us, Catherine.
Thank you.
And Lori Conroy is an assistant Clay County attorney. She joins us from the courthouse across the river in Moorhead. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thanks for having us.
We're talking about the regional rounds of the National Trial Competition. And Catherine, I'm reading this news release, and it says, for the first time in its 119-year history, the University of North Dakota School of Law, together with the State Bar Association of North Dakota, will host the regional rounds of the National Trial Competition tomorrow through Sunday at the Cass County Courthouse. So why did it take so long?
Well, we are super excited to have this opportunity to host the regional rounds. For a small law school like ours, this is no small thing to host these regional rounds. And part of the reason that they're being held in Fargo is because of the capacity of courthouse space that's needed to host the competition. So we're very grateful for the support of our bench and bar in helping us pull this off.
Well, Region 9, which is the region that will be competing tomorrow through Sunday, is North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, Kansas, and Iowa. And Lori, you've actually been in this competition, right?
I have. Myself and co-tournament director Aubrey Zuger were participants on the University of North Dakota School of Law trial team. We were actually teammates. Aubrey was a year ahead of me in law school, so we competed together my second year, her third year of law school. Aubrey's team advanced to the nationals down in Texas, held every year there. And the following year, my third year, UND took a team to nationals that I was a part of. So we have not only been competitors, we have coached the team, and now we've taken on another role, and we have a whole new appreciation for all of those hosts over the years that we participated and coached teams.
Well, Lori, it's one thing to crack a law book, quite another to stand before a judge and make a case. So describe the experience.
I think it was one of the most important experiences of my law school career. The as you said, there is a difference between learning to think like a lawyer and learning to present yourself and advocate in a courtroom setting. And for me, it secured my first job out of law school. I took the skills that I had learned in trial team and competed in the Kerrigan Cup, which is an intramural trial competition at the law school, received a card from an attorney in Fargo at a firm here, and he asked me to call him, and I was recruited from that competition. And so it's not only wonderful practical experience, it's a real resource for students to secure their first employment.
Well, Catherine, are there scouts there? I mean, is this like NFL scouts showing up at the university's football game?
Not formally, of course, but it is an opportunity for students to make an impression on future employers and even the judges that they will end up practicing in front of. We're so proud of how our students compete at this level against schools that are larger and have more robust resources to support their trial teams. But as you heard from Lori, our students hold their own and do very well.
How much practical experience do law school students have before they graduate, Catherine?
Well, they're required to have at least 6 credits of experiential coursework. And this trial team competition for our UND law students counts toward that 6 credits. But we encourage students to do much more than that, to work during the summers in paid positions, to have externships or field placements while they're law students, and to take other simulation courses in addition to the trial team.
Well, Catherine and Lori, public speaking is often cited as a common fear. So what kind of preparation do law school students have in making public presentations?
Well, from the standpoint of the students and competitors, it's several fold. It's not just public speaking, but it's learning to apply the law to the facts of a particular circumstance, whether it's an argument or a case, and to successfully advocate your side. And so it's even more complicated than public speaking, in my opinion, having done it, now as a career and as a student. And so it's learning how to effectively marshal the facts, how to effectively marshal the law, and then delivery. One of the things that I think historically UND Law has done very well is to teach students how to be concise, how to articulate how the law supports their particular argument, and how to be appropriate in the courtroom. And that's everything from how to present yourself not as a distraction, but as a conduit for the message, how to appropriately address opposing counsel, to argue against their position, but not argue with them. All of those types of things are things that the coaches who have been employed by UND Law have taught the students over the years.
Catherine, how is the competition conducted? Do you have a case? Do you have a problem that you have to parse out in front of a judge?
Yes, the students are provided with a problem that they work on, and Lori would have a better sense than I do of exactly how that happens, speaking as a tournament organizer and a former coach. But I also want to mention that Lori's point about how the students actually conduct themselves is an important one. We're very proud to be part of this competition. It's known for supporting ethical practice in the courtroom, and that's something that we emphasize with our students who compete.
So you won't have those moments like, if it doesn't fit, you must acquit?
Sure, exactly.
Lori, how are the duties of team members determined?
The coach determines assignments and roles within a team. The way that this particular competition is organized is that each school can enter 2 teams in the tournament. And that team can be made up of as many as 6 people. So you would have 2 separate teams with up to 3 student attorneys on each side. Once the team receives the problem, then the coach generally works through the problem and identifies student attorneys who would fit a particular role. For example, this year is a civil problem, and so there would be expert witnesses and everyday people who are witnesses in the trial. And there may be some students who are more suited to handle the everyday witnesses and some more suited to handle the expert witnesses. Some students more appropriate to handle an opening statement, others more capable of handling a closing argument. And so the individual coach makes that decision. But one important thing is that each team has to be prepared to try both sides of the case. So again, this year, this is a civil problem. In some rounds, a team will be on the plaintiff's side, so the person bringing the claim. And then in other rounds, they'll be on the defense side, so they'll be defending against the claim. And the skill that's taught by that is really to analyze all sides of an issue and be able to anticipate and rebut the other side's argument.
Who are the judges?
The judges, we're very proud to say, as Dean Rand mentioned, that we have had so much wonderful support from our bench and bar in the state of North Dakota and throughout the region, really, because this is sponsored by the American College of Trial Lawyers, which is an invitation-only group. To be a fellow in the college, you have to have tried a minimum number of cases and then be of exceptional character as well. We have American College of Trial Lawyers coming from different states to come and judge as far away as Kansas. We also have a number of district court judges throughout the state of North Dakota, fellows from the college in North Dakota and Minnesota. We are very proud to say that all of the federal bench and the North Dakota Supreme Court will be judging this competition. That's everyone from 8th Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Erickson, the entire North Dakota Supreme Court, all of the district court judges and magistrate judges as well.
Catherine, I looked at this news release and my eyes popped out when I saw more than 400 volunteers are needed to hold the competition. What do they do?
I know this is a large-scale effort on our part, and we couldn't do it without the incredible work of Lori and Aubrey, as well as the support of the bench and bar. Volunteers serve as bailiffs. They play the parts of witnesses, and they're also just there to make sure that whatever is needed to ensure that the competition is run smoothly and fairly happens the way that it should.
It sounds a little bit like a theater. I mean, you're playing roles, aren't you?
You know, in my years of coaching, I have told the students that they should always remember that there is a bit of theater in the courtroom.
What happens next for the winning team? They go to Texas and compete? Is that it?
So this region will send two teams to the national competition. Each region is represented by two teams, and they will advance down to nationals. What will happen is after the regional rounds are complete, there will be a brand new case that is disseminated to the regional round qualifiers to nationals, and they will have to start this process all over again. Again, as a practical matter, this is what practicing litigators do every day. Turn to the next case that's waiting for them, the next pile on their desk. And so they have to come up with a theme and theory, draft all of their examinations, be prepared to admit the exhibits, and then they'll head down to Texas. And it's a wonderful experience in Texas. The American College of Trial Lawyers and the Texas Young Lawyers Association really roll out the red carpet for the students there. And you get a chance to see the area. They host several receptions for the students. You, each qualifying team member receives what's called the Powell Medal. I think mine is sitting on my office shelf here as I look over at it. So it's something that is really near and dear to those who make it that far to their heart.
Is there a monetary prize?
There are some monetary prizes for the winning school and the runner-up teams as well. And, of course, that is not what makes the school most proud of their winning team. What makes them most proud is the excellence that their students have shown.
Can the public attend?
This weekend, the courthouse, of course, generally is closed, but the rounds are open for people to watch. If individuals do want to come and watch the rounds, they have to go through security at the Cass County Courthouse. But folks are welcome to watch the students if they choose.
All right. Lori Conroy, Assistant Clay County Attorney, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Catherine Rand, Dean of the UND School of Law, congratulations.
Thanks so much. We're really grateful to have the competition hosted by UND School of Law this year.
The regional rounds of the National Trial Competition start tomorrow, go through Sunday at the Cass County Courthouse. From Friday, they run from 5 to 9, Saturday from 8:30 to 4:30, and Sunday from 8 to 4. Coming up on Main Street, a Natural North Dakota report about backyard bird counts. Chef Rosie will talk about eggnog, and Ashley Thornburg and I will look at what's happening on our calendar of things to do this weekend. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Bad news for farmers this year. They're expected to see the lowest income since 2006. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has more on the U.S. Department of Agriculture report.
The report says low prices for crops like corn and soybeans will continue to hurt farmers in 2018, and they'll be paying more for fuel and labor. Overall, total farm income across the U.S. is predicted to drop nearly 7% from last year to less than $60 billion. Scott Gerlt is a market analyst with University of Missouri. He says while droughts or floods could change these numbers, this year trade deals could play a bigger role.
If there's uncertainty about trade, it will create uncertainty for prices and these forecasts as a result. That's probably far and away the biggest unknown.
U.S. dairy farmers will likely see declining milk prices, while beef ranchers can expect a slight increase in business. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
Grand Forks is in the early stages of crafting a zoning ordinance should a medical marijuana facility be located in the city. The North Dakota Health Department recently established 8 regions for medical pot dispensaries centered around the state's largest cities. A Grand Forks city planner, Brad Gangler, told members of the Planning and Zoning Commission last night that the state will ultimately be responsible for choosing a dispensary within each region.
The unique part, I think, about the state law is that the only limitation in terms of zoning is these compassion centers, and we use that synonymously with a dispensary or a manufacturer, cannot be located within 1,000 feet of a pre-existing public or private school.
Gangler says it's up to local governing bodies to decide if any other restrictions should be put into place. He says staff will likely recommend the city restrict a compassion center to a B3 district or commercial corridor.
No matter where it's located, the function of it is retail sales, and we only allow retail sales in certain districts. So that excludes your residentials, even industrial districts.
A rough draft of the ordinance is expected to come before the P&Z next month. State voters approved medical marijuana in November in November 2016. And the North Dakota School Boards Association is holding a seminar on negotiations in Bismarck. This comes as school districts are struggling with tight budgets. The 2017 legislature did not cut funding for local schools, but it didn't increase funding either. North Dakota School Boards Association Executive Director Alexis Baxley says that's put a number of districts between a rock and a hard place.
A lot of districts have their teachers on increased schedules or tiers, and so they're looking at those things, and districts want to do good by their teachers. They want to be able to pay their teachers well, and so it is between a rock and a hard place, because when you don't have the money, you don't have the money, but you have to look at how do you retain that top talent that you have and continue to reward them for that.
Baxley says last year a number of school districts settled with their teachers on one-year contracts instead of 2 years, and she says a number went to impasse. But she says she thinks teachers will have a better understanding of the financial limitations some districts have.
But I do anticipate a lot of districts to look at things other than fiscal issues, whether it be the safe work environment like a number of districts dealt with last year or other policy type issues.
The seminar runs through Friday. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Bill Thomas. Well, the Prairie Public Valentine's Day tradition of the short and sweet drive is over. Thanks to Atomic Coffee and Sandy's Donuts and Nicole's, but especially big thanks to everyone who made a contribution. Enjoy those truffles if you got them, but certainly enjoy Prairie Public. You helped pay for it. If you missed it, we keep the door open till Thursday. PrairiePublic.org or 800-359-4145. Thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In today's Natural North Dakota essay, Dakota College of Botanobiology professor Chuck Lura talks about the great backyard bird count. It's set for next weekend, and it's an opportunity for bird watchers of all ages to count birds and create a real-time snapshot of where those birds are.
Bird watchers of all ages and knowledge levels are helping ornithologists better understand the population dynamics and movements of birds around the world, and you can be a part of that effort. If you're interested in taking a few minutes to help the cause, consider participating in the Great Backyard Bird Count this year. It's a joint effort of the Cornell University Lab of Ornithology and the National Audubon Society, and it's coming up Friday, February 16th through Monday the 19th. Many of you have no doubt noticed that the abundance and diversity of bird species in and around your homes and feeders during the winter can be quite variable. Scientists are trying to better understand those differences. And with your help, they can obtain some real-time data on where the birds are each year during 4 days in February. Around the globe last year, over 200,000 bird enthusiasts compiled over 170,000 checklists documenting the location and abundance of over 5,000 species. Here in the United States, over 113,000 checklists documented the location and abundance of over 600 species of birds. Participating is easy, and by no means do you have to be a bird expert. As their website notes, participating is as easy as 1, 2, 3. You just count the birds in your area for at least 15 minutes for as many of the days as you like. Count the greatest number of individuals of each species you see together at any one time. Then when you're finished, submit your results. You can check out the Great Backyard Bird Count website at birdcount.org. You'll find all the information necessary to participate, as well as lots of good information on the project and birds in general. They even have a special section for kids, and the bird count could be a great school or class project. And of course, observers of all ages can cooperate and perhaps even have some friendly competition. A computer is needed to submit your results, but if you don't have a computer or you don't want to mess with it, find a friend or family member to help you out. It's easy, and it really is fun to do. Plus, shortly after the bird count, you can explore the results online. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
We were absolutely forbidden from falling in love with Muslims. I mean, by the time I was 10, I knew that when a Christian Arab girl falls in love with a Muslim, one or all of the following would happen. She is disowned, her mother gets a heart attack, or she dies in an honor killing.
Join us for stories about the things we do in the name of love. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Chef Tim Rosendahl. It's time to talk about food.
And we are going to talk about eggnog, one of the things that makes winter survivable.
You know, we're not talking about the small town in Utah, eggnog. We're not talking about the album by the infamous, well, maybe just unheard of, the Melvins. Nor are we talking about the eggnog riot.
Wait,
that
did
happened.
You just say the Melvins are unheard of? Oh, okay. Oh, come on.
Ashley, you're a little bit younger than me. Oh, I mean a lot younger than me. Melvins, to me, were, yes, unheard of.
But eggnog at, trivia. Oh, okay.
At West Point in 1826, they had an eggnog riot because they had eliminated it from the cafeteria. And so that became a big thing, the eggnog riot. But the whole thing about eggnog, as we think of it in the Midwest here, is it is a holiday drink. But as you research eggnog more, it's more than just a holiday drink. It's the whole winter. It's something for the cold months of the year. We see it more so from Thanksgiving to Christmas and New Year's. But it is a, well, let's not forget, winter up here can be 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, and we're pushing it this year maybe. Who knows?
But I'm not seeing so much eggnog in the stores anymore, so how about making it?
Well, you know, the thing about making it, and it is so simple to make, the only thing you have to be careful of is when you're – it's made with raw eggs. So you can buy organic eggs at the store. You can buy pasteurized eggs at the store. And what we're looking at is the bacteria, primarily the salmonella. If you're going to make it – make it to drink that day or the next day or within 3 days because you're using raw egg yolks and raw egg whites. And I could never say you should – that's okay to age because that would be so wrong. But if you're going to age it, and that's another interesting fact that I learned, is that there are a lot of people and parts of the world that take great pride in putting away eggnog for months and months, if not more than a year.
And how do you do that?
Well, the secret is, and I'll go through the recipe in a second, but the whole idea, when you age it, it's with alcohol in it. I grew up where we put a splash of brandy or a splash of rum or a splash of cognac. Mm-hmm. Well, when you make it with alcohol, it can be up to 66% alcohol. And one, so that's one third eggnog. So now we're not talking. You don't drink an 8 ounce glass of it because it's high proof. And we have it when we make it with that up to 20% or more proof, then we have killed the bacteria. We've killed the salmonella.
I don't think I've ever had that eggnog.
No.
Yeah, I haven't either. That's real strong, and that's the whole aging concept. So maybe next year when I make a batch, I'll put it away. And of course,
a note in your phone right now for September.
Yeah, right.
To invite us to your Christmas party.
So you have milk, cream, sugar, and these eggs that you make eggnog with. Can you flavor it with some other notes?
Well, the whole idea is, you know, I grew up sprinkling it with cinnamon or shaved fresh nutmeg or allspice or things that went on the top of it. The whole idea is eggnog is very rich. So, yes, I always made it with heavy cream or half and half. But can you make it with milk? Can you make it with skim milk? Can you make it with almond milk? You can do all of those things. And, Doug, you asked me earlier if we could eliminate the egg yolks and use egg beaters, egg whites.
Mm-hmm.
Well, pretty soon if you make with almond milk and you use egg whites and you cut back on the sugar – pretty soon, I don't know if we're allowed to use the word eggnog anymore.
Yeah.
Just nog, I think.
Yeah, because rich and creamy are what goes – that's what we think of in our mind. Thick, rich, creamy, sweet drink.
And lots of calories and lots of fat.
Yeah, 350 calories per cup and 150 milligrams of cholesterol per cup. So that's
use this in moderation.
The most delicious way. Yeah.
So the next time you decide to have a couple of cups of eggnog, you might want to think about the caloric count.
Well, obviously, the stuff that you get in the store, one, not alcoholic, two, they wouldn't be doing raw egg in there.
Right. They're using pasteurized eggs. So okay. That brings the safety to it. So it does have a use by date on the container. But once you pasteurize the dairy product, the safety is all there.
Okay.
We don't have the problem with it at all.
Well, besides having a big glass of eggnog with a big splash of something in it, how else can we use eggnog to cook with?
Well, you know, I have some favorites. And one, of course, is eggnog, whether it's pancakes, French toast, or waffles, just eliminate the dairy product and put it in any one of those, and you may never switch back. Mm-hmm. And even when the grocery store doesn't have it, you may learn how to make it real quick. Because it brings a whole other level of texture to French toast or pancakes. So that would be one of my favorites. But also think of eggnog when you make something as simple as hot chocolate or cocoa.
I never thought of that.
Yeah. I remember a chef talking to me once about marinating chicken breasts and marinating salmon in
eggnog?
And I've never had it, but I remember this German chef talking to me about it years ago in my restaurant in Miami. But that I couldn't find anybody doing a savory recipe with eggnog. And we talk a lot in this show about sweet and savory uses of products. But I don't want to be the one to say I'm going to rush home and try to make a marinated chicken or pork loin with eggnog.
So, but instead of putting milk in your coffee or cream in your coffee, you put eggnog in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even things making icing for a cheesecake with eggnog would be wonderful. The whole idea is eggnog – to make the consistency or the thickness in eggnog comes from a very simple method, and that's bringing the heavy cream or whatever dairy product you decide to use to a simmer and then slowly whisking in the egg yolks. Remember, you add the egg yolks to the cream, not the cream to the egg yolks, because otherwise you'll end up with scrambled eggs. And you whisk it, and you just keep whisking it until – not until your arm gets sore, but until it gets to the thickness that you want it to be. And then sugar and cinnamon and all those things, you can add as much as you want.
So if you can adjust the thickness, you can make a syrup out of it or something like that.
Absolutely. It becomes a syrup that you can use on pancakes. You can make an icing for cookies or an icing for brownies or bread pudding made with eggnog. It's just a whole – every one of them just when you say it with eggnog instead of just milk or just half and half, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
There's an eggnog liqueur on the market now, rum chata, which is similar, has some, and I'm seeing rum chata French toast around, and I'm seeing that much more often. And that's only a liqueur that I've heard of for the last few years.
If you were going to make eggnog into something more like a frozen dessert, would it turn out more like an ice cream or more like a gelato?
More like Spumoni.
More like Spumoni.
More like a bisque, a frozen bisque, because it's going to be high fat, high egg yolks, very rich. It would make a wonderful ice cream, a wonderful sorbet. Won't make a sherbet because it has dairy product in it. But yes, making an ice cream or a bisque or a Spumoni with eggnog would just brings it to a whole nother level. You can cut the portion size down in half because you've raised the fat doubled the fat content.
Oh, bon appetit. If you have a question for Chef Rosie,
send it to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or find us on Facebook. We are Main Street at Prairie Public.
What's happening is next.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. This week, I chat with Ann Fadiman, author of The Wine Lover's Daughter, a memoir about her father, Clifton Fadiman, who was a famous literary critic, editor, and radio game show host. We visit the 85-year-old Ray Alvarez, who still runs New York's only 24-hour ice cream store, and Dr. Aaron Carroll talks about raw cookie dough. Coming up this week on Mill Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday at 1 Central, noon Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Well, that's the big question. The weekend is coming up. What can we do to, make it feel a little bit warmer? Ashley Thornburg and I look at our list of things to do. We call it What's Happening. And Ashley, what's happening?
Well, if you want to go a little bit warmer, how about go and take in a nice play, be in a nice setting with lots of people. Of course, you do have to probably go outside to get to that play, but, whatever. How about this one? Check out Capital Shakespeare presenting The Dining Room, Friday through Sunday, February 9th through 11th. In Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center's Russell Reed Auditorium. This is a mosaic of interrelated scenes. Some are funny, some are touching, and that kind of culminate all together in a richly humorous theatrical tour de force. This is at 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and on Sunday there is a 2 o'clock matinee of The Dining Room, and it's free, but donations are accepted.
Marjorie Prime is opening this evening at Theater B in Moorhead. It runs through weekends. The year is 2062, and technology plays a role in caregiving and memory retention for the aging. Marjorie needs help remembering things, and her family's stories are distorted by the limits of recollection and the vastness of grief. When lines between human and technological assistance become blurred, who holds the truth? The curtain is at 7:30. With Sunday matinees at 2 o'clock on February 11th, this Sunday and the 18th. Student nights are $5, so this is the night to go. Otherwise, it's $10 for students. Adults and seniors are $20, with a special rate for seniors on Sunday matinees of $17.
World War I Nutrition, Then and Now. This is actually coming up a week from now, Thursday, February 15th, in Valley City at the Barnes County Museum. This is part of their lecture series for season 19 for that. And we are talking about World War I Nutrition. This is, of course, we've noticed the world of nutrition. We're constantly getting new information, and it is changing. But that doesn't mean there wasn't wisdom in what was then. So they are looking back on what was good nutritional advice back then, how that compares to what we know now, what we can learn from the past, and maybe what they probably wish they knew back then. This gets going at 7 p.m. in Valley City at the Barnes County Museum, Thursday, February 15th, and the cost is free.
Well, I'll keep it on food. Soup It Up Social is Saturday in Minot at the Taube Museum of Art. Soup, bread, desserts, art, fun, and two floors of it. Soup will be served from 11 in the morning till 1:30. The doors open at 10:30 in the morning on Saturday for shopping with the artisans and crafters who will be selling their wares. No ticket is needed to shop for your favorite artist. There will be a silent auction. There will be door prizes. And as in previous years, for the price of a soup ticket, the first 100 attendees will take home a handcrafted ceramic soup bowl created by the Minot State University Ceramics Department. And tickets are available at the Taube Museum of Art cart or online. Again, it starts at 10:30 Saturday morning. The cost for non-members is $17, members $15, children 8 and under half price. But that one does not include the ceramic bowl. So Soup It Up Social this Saturday in Minot.
The Veterans Creative Arts Festival, Wednesday, February 14th in Fargo at the VA Medical Center Auditorium, the Department of Veterans Affairs Military Facilities. Come together nationwide to use creative arts as one of the sort of auxiliary, supplementary rehab treatments for veterans. And you can check out the work that they are doing here. A lot of visual arts from oil painting to leather work, even some paint-by-number kits. There is also going to be performing arts in the form of music, dance, drama, even a little creative writing. 11:30 to 3 p.m. on display here in Fargo at the VA Medical Center Auditorium, and it is free.
Well, this looks like fun. The first LEGO League State Robotics Championship Tournament is Saturday in Grand Forks at the University of North Dakota Memorial Union. Over 40 teams of 9 to 14-year-old students from North Dakota and Minnesota are expected to participate. Each team with 3 to 10 students will spend months, or has spent months, developing creative problem-solving, teamwork, and math and science technology skills toward the goal of the creation of a functional robot to perform specific tasks related to the competition theme. It runs from 7:30 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon at the Memorial Union at UND. It's Saturday, and again, it's free.
Sweets for the Sweet, an evening of love songs and romance, Tuesday, February 13th in Bismarck at the Heritage Center and State Museum. This is a Valentine Street, and you can spend the evening with the Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus as they will be performing romantic music. And there's also going to be some nice food that will be served, including, of course, a wine tasting and a dessert buffet. It is Valentine's Day, after all. You can even book a private serenade. 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday the 13th in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. The cost is $25, and tickets do have to be purchased in advance, so reach out to them if you want those tickets.
Well, food, glorious food. The 56th annual Feast of Nations is Saturday in Grand Forks at the Alaris Center. The UND's first ever Feast of Nations was held in 1961. It's organized by students in the campus's international organization. It started as a small group of people preparing a dinner in order to share their cultures. The Feast of Nations has grown into the biggest multicultural event in the region, so take it in. It's 5 o'clock on Saturday at the Alaris Center in Grand Forks. The tickets are $25 for students, $35 for general admission. And what's your pick this week?
Well, my pick is that it is Giving Hearts Day. All day long, this 24-hour online fundraiser for a number of nonprofits across the region. You can just Google Giving Hearts Day or Impact Foundation. Find any number of great charities to support and get your money doubled in a lot of cases.
Well, my pick is related to that. The Fargo Famous Talent Show is this evening at the Stage at Island Park in Fargo. That's where the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater is headquartered. It's a talent show and a Giving Hearts Day fundraiser for the community theater featuring local performers. It starts at 7 o'clock, and a minimum donation of $10 will get you into the show, and it will directly benefit FMCT on Giving Hearts Day. But as Ashley said, just Google Giving Hearts Day, go online. There are hundreds of selections up there, and it's important to raise what we can in the 24 hours that the day provides us. That's what's happening.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 8th. Charles Whedon Westover was born December 30, 1934, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and grew up in the nearby farming town of Coopersville. At a young age, his mother taught him ukulele, but by age 14, he had gravitated to the guitar. The instrument became a part of him. He brought it everywhere, even to school. After repeated episodes of getting kicked out of class for strumming, his principal sent him to the boys' locker room to play. This future rock legend changed his name to Del Shannon in 1958. He adopted the name while living in Battle Creek and playing shows at the Hilo Club. Shannon came from a famous wrestler, and Del was derived from the Cadillac Coupe de Ville, his favorite car. In 1961, he recorded Runaway, which became a huge hit. He was on fire and went on to produce three more top 40 songs that year. He had some flops in 1962, but by 63, he was back recording top hits. 5 years after Runaway, his stardom began to fade. He continued to create music, but never reached the success of the 60s. On February 3, 1990, Del Shannon played his last concert. It was at the Civic Center in Fargo. At the age of 55, and despite coming off a bout with the flu, his playing and singing were still in prime condition. Clips on YouTube show him jamming out to his hits and joking around with the lighting crew. An audience member said it was a great show. Unfortunately, backstage was a different story. Dale Hanisch of Watertown, South Dakota, who helped promote the concert, said he could tell something was off. He said Shannon looked sunken and thin. In the middle of the show, Shannon went backstage to tell Hanisch he was too sick to continue, but Hanisch urged him to finish. Shannon did, starting his encore with, of course, Runaway. 5 days later, on this date, February 8, 1990, Shannon took his own life at his home in Santa Clarita, California, after years of struggling with alcoholism and depression. 9 years after his death, Del Shannon was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Jamaica is sending its first women's bobsled team to the Olympics, and the team driver sees this as an opportunity to inspire future generations.
It's extremely important for young kids nowadays to see representation in sports of people that look like them.
Breaking barriers on the world stage. Also, the latest developments on budget talks in Congress. That's all in the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Just a moment here to let you know that if you're interested in a short and sweet incentive for your Valentine this year, our one-pound box of Nicole's Fine Pastry Truffles is still available for a sustaining membership of $10 a month or $120 a year. It's easy to get. Call us 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org. Friday on Main Street, UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein will preview this month's Why radio show. It's titled A Philosophical Look at the Midlife Crisis. And every Friday, we check in with our news director Dave Thompson for a review of the week's big stories. And Matt Olien reviews a film. On Friday, he'll offer his opinion about I, Tonya. I hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.